Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there. Today, we're speaking with Lorenzo Tione, general partner at Gangels. Gangels is the leading venture investment syndicate in support and representing the LGBTQ plus community and its allies in venture capital. Lorenzo, thank you so much for joining us today. We are honored to have Gangels as a great partner to us, and we're really looking forward to the conversation. So to kick it off, why don't you tell us a little bit about the story behind Gangels and the mission?
Yeah, so I feel like I've spent most of my career at the intersection of entrepreneurship, investment, venture, and advocacy for more representation and equity and access in pretty much everything I've done. And to go back to understand a little bit of the origins of Gangels, you have to go back to an organization I started after the exit of a prior company I started. So I was a technical co-founder of another startup. Awesome experience, learned a ton from the other side of the venture deal-making table, so to speak. And after that exit, sold the company to Microsoft in 2008, I actually co-founded a not-for-profit called Startout. And Startout is actually still today the largest nonprofit network dedicated to supporting LGBTQ entrepreneurs in venture, in high-velocity, large-scale companies. And it does so through education, mentorship, networking, connection to other investors. They have an incubator now. But one of the things that it never did because of its nature as a nonprofit was the direct facilitation of investment. And in fact, I met the founders of Gangels, Paul and David, through the Startout Network, and they met each other through the Startout Network. So I often joke that while I didn't found Gangels, I laid the ground for the Petri dish in which it would be incubated. But I became one of their earliest investors in what was originally just an angel group. They'll tell you it was a hobby as a side project, angel group of LGBT investors investing in LGBT founders, sort of a way to support the community, providing more funding to underrepresented founders, much like other efforts that were happening at that same time. This was 2013, in looking at various segments of the underrepresented populations and the discrepancy in the funding that they would receive from traditional venture capital. There were other investors that were focused on Black entrepreneurs or women entrepreneurs, and Gangels was specifically focused on LGBTQ entrepreneurs. I was one of David and Paul's earliest investors for a number of years and continued my career as an active venture investor and serial entrepreneur. I had two other businesses that I was building at that time. In 2018 was when we got a chance to reevaluate the fit of what Gangels was and the mission at its core. The mission at the core was always that of trying to make venture as an ecosystem, one that was better by creating more opportunities for representation, for diversity, inclusion at all levels of leadership, and ultimately to make it more accessible for entrepreneurs that may not have the connections or the network that the mainstream group of founders would have. And the reality is that we took stock of two things. One is that this is not and was not a problem that affected one group of entrepreneurs at the exclusion of others. It was true, and it is still true for women, female identifying, LGBT, people of color, of many ethnic minorities, where their representation in population does not keep up with the amount of funding that they receive, and their ability to access opportunities is undersized compared to mainstream entrepreneurs. And the second is that we would have a lot more impact if we were able to participate and have an influence on more companies and more organizations as opposed to fewer. So that was the big shift that happened in 2018. And at the end of 2018, I actually joined David and Paul as a full-time partner in the organization, just as we inflected up in our growth and changed the model from what was a small angel group to becoming a venture syndicate that was stage agnostic, sector agnostic, and to some extent, even founder agnostic, in the sense that we were no longer limiting ourselves to investing in underrepresented founders or LGBT founders for that matter, but rather we're investing in both diversity where diversity already was, and that included women and people of color and other underrepresented minorities, but also in every company where they would align with us in bring more diversity onto their leadership, onto their staff, onto their board, and even onto their cap table. And this was one of the things that was really not talked about in 2018 at all, which is diversity of capital sources. And as we grew our group of investors, much because we started out from an underrepresented minority, we continued to grow our base of investors and syndicate members in over-indexing in diversity. And so when we are evaluating an investment and talking to a company about what we can do with them and for them is really about helping them with talent and sourcing talent from diverse backgrounds, helping place independent board members from underrepresented backgrounds onto our company's board, and bring truly diverse sources of capital onto their cap table, creating more access for individual investors who would have the means, but not traditionally the access, especially in the later stage top VC-led opportunities. And this was really embraced by companies and co-investors alike that saw us as an important piece of what we could do with them, for them, helping them not just tick a box, but really helping all of those portfolio companies realize on the ideas of building a more diverse and inclusive organization.
Absolutely. And I know that Gangels has an expansive portfolio. I think you've invested in over 800 companies since the genesis of Gangels in 2014. How do you source those opportunities? Are they mostly inbound, or how does that work?
At this point, we look at this as a flywheel, and that flywheel is made of the companies that we invest in that are top venture-led backed companies that ideally will generate and are generating best-in-class returns for our investors, the community of investors and founders that we are fostering and creating and supporting, and our ability to influence those companies towards more diversity and support them into building diverse and inclusive organization. As this flywheel starts spinning, each individual party within this ecosystem is motivated to bring more opportunities to Gangels. And that is individual investors and LPs who are often very looped in into the ecosystem and the venture ecosystem and are referring deal flow to us. The co-investors and therefore all the venture partners and venture capital investors that are leading or participating in deals and see Gangels and maybe have experienced Gangels because we've done dozens of deals with each one of them as a valuable partner and bring opportunities to us, and the individual founders as well who are having a good experience and referring other founders, or maybe they're coming back for their next company and whatnot. There is a certain amount of outbound where, because we're partnered with so many venture firms and so venture capital firms, will actively reach out and proactively say, hey, these companies in your portfolio are great. We haven't invested in them. It might be time for them to raise more money. We'd love to just have a chance to meet with them, to tell them what we're about, to describe how we can help. And even if they're not investing right now, if they're not raising right now, there might be an opportunity in the future. And that has really served us well in building strong ties to companies that lead us to participate in rounds that from the outside look like oversubscribed competitive of opportunities. And it's just because we're building that relationship and often going out on a limb and helping companies with their hiring or with their board even before we get a chance to invest.
I know you obviously invest in a lot of companies and you do write up the story as you make these opportunities available to your investors. Is it like an open syndication network though, in the sense that you open it up to your investors and whoever wants to invest can come in? You're not traditional managers in the sense that you're opining, right?
Yeah, we are definitely not. We're acting very different from a traditional VC where we're making few concentrated bets into what we believe is ultimately the company that is going to win with that particular approach. We are effectively, you have to think back about what we're doing this, which is certainly generating capital returns is an important way of how the flywheel spins, but ultimately is to have a broad and impactful effect on as many organizations as possible, creating these conditions for more inclusion and representation at all levels, right? So we want to be in more great high quality deals as opposed to be in fewer. When people join our syndicate, I would say we are still meeting and trying to get to know each and every one of our individual members, which is hard. We actually do dozens of in-person events all around the country, connecting members to each other and connecting with them, because we think that's such an important reason why people actually join and want to engage with our portfolio and our companies, and they see us motivated by this mission. But each individual investor does decide on their own whether or not they want to participate in deal A or deal B and how much they want to invest. Now, with the expansion of both our operations and our portfolio, we've had to at least augment this approach with a couple of other more traditional funds. We actually have a very early stage vehicle, which we called Spark, and that fund invests in early stage companies, typically with small checks. And so that provides an additional opportunity to investing in deals and with checks that traditional syndication would not make a lot of sense for.
Got it. That makes sense. And if I was an entrepreneur and let's say I got an investment from your group, would I be able to have access to your network or resources to, say, expand my diversity in my company or for hiring?
That is the core of both how we work with portfolio companies and why we want to invest, is so that we can put our entire network and resources to work with each one. And the great thing is that we really don't care about how much money we invest in each one. I mean, it could be a $50,000 check, it could be a $10 million investment. The amount of support that they receive and the attention that they receive is the same. And we do this around four primary axes. One is talent sourcing, right? Every company is always trying to find talent, and they realize that they need to look into places where they haven't looked before so that they can maximize the chances that they're bringing true diversity into their company. And so we, first of all, run a job portal for all of our portfolio companies where portfolio companies can submit all of their open positions. And then we promote that to our larger community, not just investors, but even our community members who participate in some of our events and socials and so on, who might be looking for jobs or might know people who are looking for jobs. And we promote that each week, profiling different companies, different types of jobs, and so on. We also work with several of our own portfolio companies who are in the business of providing a talent recruitment platform specifically applied to diversity. And we help them connect with our other portfolio companies so that they can take advantage of their work. On the advisory and independent and board of directors side, we actually run an in-house recruiting agency or practice, so to speak, that works with our portfolio companies at no cost to them to basically submit candidates that are qualified and a fit for what that company is looking for and are faring from underrepresented minority backgrounds, women, people of color, LGBTQ. We work with two dozen external organizations who are basically running databases and maintaining databases of great, skilled, high-quality candidates who are qualified and often serve on public boards already that want to help diversify the private sector, each from different backgrounds. And we help with the company to craft and submit job descriptions for those roles, and then submit candidates and help throughout that process. We have actually successfully put forth the candidate that won a board position in 11 of our portfolio companies and are in active conversations with about 30 other companies helping them with their board search. Overall, we've helped over 390 candidates be seen, viewed, vetted, qualified, interviewed for positions at boards of our portfolio companies, which by itself is an important metric to keep an eye on because it helps dispel the notion that it is a pipeline issue or that there are no candidates that one should actually be interviewing for those positions from underrepresented backgrounds. The last thing that we do, because we have such a broad portfolio and because we have so many individual investors who are themselves founders or at large Fortune 500 companies, the value of connecting companies to each other and creating opportunities for founders to learn from other founders, to connect with other CXO levels, community events that we run, as well as submitting asks to our larger network of investors, has often resulted in a very quick answer to things that our companies are really needing for. And so the scale of the portfolio doesn't only help us on the impact that we're having, but it also helps in delivering direct value to our own portfolio companies because they'll often find other founders, other companies, or individual members whose network is critical for them to receive the help that they're looking for.
And how many members do you have to date? And if someone's interested in becoming a member, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, we have about 2,600 members. And at this point, it grows a lot by word of mouth and referral, and people find us online and so on. And it's really easy to just learn more about Gangels. People can head out to gangels.com, and there's an easy online application process. Effectively, there's two sides of that. One is more obvious. People need to be accredited investors, and there will be a KYC process that we go through. And then the second is really a call with one of us where we'll literally make sure that we have a Zoom call with each new member that joins to not just learn about them, what they're interested in, what their background and how they could help other companies, but really talking about the mission and why we're doing what we're doing and making sure that we're not just aligned on that mission, but that there is also availability and interest in helping our portfolio with more than just investing dollars. I mean, this is an important and valuable way for people to realize and build wealth, but at the same time, it's a really meaningful way to create an effect social change through business. We believe in that you can do well by doing good or vice versa. So we want to always make sure that there's a frank and open conversation with each one of our members when they join.
Is there a company that you'd like to speak about either within the Gangels overall portfolio or within Spark? Curious to hear about
in,
that.
In what way? Like just a favorite company altogether?
Just like, a company that you'd like to touch on and maybe ways that you added value.
There are so many
I was going to say Cerebral.
Cerebral comes from the fact that I've known Kyle for many years, and we were fortunate to have an opportunity to support Kyle and his team early on. Actually, Cerebral was also a graduate company of the Startout Growth Lab. So it actually went through the incubator the Startout provides, which is a double success story, so to speak, from the point of view of supporting LGBTQ entrepreneurs.
You want to say what Cerebral does just for the audience?
Yeah. So Cerebral is, and by the way, Kyle Robertson, who's the founder and CEO of Cerebral, is also profiled in the Gangels 100, which we recently published. It's a collection and an awesome coffee book with 100 amazing stories from venture-backed LGBTQ entrepreneurs from all over the world. And Cerebral is a digital health platform that delivers care, medication management, psychotherapy, as well as other wellness telecare opportunities for people struggling with mental health. And now they've added also nutrition management and others. So it's like a well-rounded wellness platform, really stemming from the need to destigmatize mental health care. It started in the United States and it now just recently expanded also to the UK. So massive growth in just a handful of years. So big, big success stories from the point of view of Gangels and our members investing in their first round and then several times after as the company continued to grow and raised more capital, which is another amazing way in which building that relationship allows us to continue to invest. And being this really large scale syndicate also allows us to be able to play very early with relatively small checks, but going all the way to pre-IPO rounds with very large investments, which is something that traditional other firms, unless we're talking about a handful of firms with completely different practices, early stage, seed, and very late stage, it's typically not something that other firms can do. But I was going
to
say,
you didn't have to say Cerebral.
I don't have favorites, just much like parents shouldn't have favorite children. I do think that there are some really incredible organizations that are not just doing well as companies, but they're really solving big problems and having a big impact on the world. There's a handful of companies. One that we've invested in is called American Gene Technologies that are now very, very close to potentially delivering a functional cure to HIV that are in our portfolio. And I often say that as an example of something that is really meaningful for an organization that was born out of the LGBTQ community, a community that has suffered more victims to the HIV epidemic than any other specific group of people. And for us to be able to be counting amongst the early backers and believers and investors in a company that should potentially deliver the first functional cure to HIV to the world would be something really meaningful, I think.
Right. And how many investments have you guys made out of Spark?
So Spark is an annual rolling fund. So we'll basically raise a new fund every year and then deploy it and invest it. And Spark 1 and Spark 2 completed their investments. Spark 1 made about 50 investments, I believe, and Spark 2 made close to 200 investments. Oh. Spark 3 will probably do something along the lines of Spark 2.
Can you tell us a little bit about, I know you touched on this, but just your personal background. Where did you grow up? How did you get into technology? What inspired you? Give us your story.
So I was born and raised in Milan in Italy. So did not grow up in the States.
Very little accent though. I have to say.
I don't know what it is. I mean, I've always had a knack for languages to some extent, and I've always had the ability to reproduce sounds, I guess, like a good musical ear. But I also think that there is, and maybe this is psychology 101, there is part of it that says when you're growing up gay and you are in the closet, one of your biggest assets is the ability to mimic, to be mimetic and fit in and not stand out and observe what others do say, how they behave and take cues from it. And it's something that becomes innate and second nature. And so when I moved to the States, I think it just one of the abilities that I had was that of really picking up the accent, the language. I mean, I moved from Milan to Austin, Texas, and I know for a fact that for a number of years, I had a twang. And I would say things like my friends and y'all, which is not hard to do if you're living in Texas, but it goes along with that.
And what brought you to Texas? Was it college?
I got a scholarship to attend the University of Texas at Austin. So I finished up my undergrad and then did my graduate studies, master's in computer engineering in Texas. So I was already technical, had been studying computer engineering in Italy, and then moved and finished up the studies in Texas. And one of the fields that I got really interested in at that time was a sector of artificial intelligence that at the time was pretty obscure. Now it certainly has seen much more of its day in the sun, which is computational linguistics or natural language understanding and processing, which is the ability for computers to understand at a deeper level than strings and keywords, the meaning of human languages, English and others, and what underpins things like machine translation or even your Siri assistant or Google assistant. At the underpinning level, there is a deeper understanding of human languages. It's also the idea behind the Star Trek computer. I think that is probably one of the things that growing up had a little bit of an impact on me. And Star Trek ends up having a weird role in my life. If there's time, I'll tell you more about that. But so I studied computational linguistics and then became a research scientist at Xerox PARC, the laboratory in Palo Alto that pioneered technologies like the computer mouse, the graphical user interface, and the Ethernet, and worked on a project there to apply their 30 years plus natural language understanding technology to the nascent problem of web search at scale. This was the early growth years of Google, when much of it, if not all of it, was coming from link analysis and keyword frequency and relevancy, and ended up spinning out that project into its own company with my co-founders called PowerSet. That company was effectively trying to build a semantically driven or semantically powered web search engine, built some really cool technology, and hired an incredible team, and then raised venture capital. We kind of got into the 2007, 2008 years, and the capital markets were looking a little weird, and we still didn't have a product with large use, but we had some cool technology and decided we would sell. We sold the company to Microsoft and became some of the early foundational technology for Bing.com, which at the time was still called Live Search. So we were part of the launch of Bing.com and part of the slew of acquisitions that Microsoft really went out and performed in the market. And I mentioned how great that team was because I have the fortune not only of having worked with them, but to have backed so many of the companies that they went on to start. And we are, as angels, invested in two of those companies right now. I have backed three of those companies, three companies founded by former PowerSet team members, which is pretty awesome. And two out of three right now are already unicorn companies. The third one is just too new, but I'm sure it'll get there soon. So pretty awesome. And then what I did took a number of different very strange paths. I started another company called Artify, which I think was an awesome idea just at the wrong time. It was pre-social media or pre the explosion of social media, which made marketing for it really hard, but was bringing physical contemporary art at a price that people would afford into everybody's homes. And then started a social media company. It's sort of a separate effort. I mentioned how Star Trek would take a role in my life. I met the actor George Takei in 2008. He was the original Sulu in Star Trek through a very strange set of coincidences. And I got to learn about his early childhood when he was a child of six, and he and his family were imprisoned in camps in the United States because they had been descended from Japanese people who had just bombed and attacked on Pearl Harbor. And, you know, 120,000 Japanese American citizens and non-citizens in the United States were effectively deprived of their homes, their businesses, their liberty, and kept in camps, in prison camps for close to 4 years. And he was one of them. His family was one of them. And there was something about that story, the fact that I had immigrated into the US, it had taken me a long time to get my citizenship and realize what it means to build a life in such a state of precariousness when anything could happen macro politically that could completely upend it for you without no impact of your own. And also having lived in the US through September 11, I had arrived only a few months before September 11 happened. And the entire attitude towards immigrants and people that were not citizens and was so radically upended by that, that I felt a really strong connection to that story. And I was there with a good friend who is also a really talented composer and would become my business and creative partner on so many endeavors. And we got it in our head, and as crazy as that sounds, that we would write a musical with George Takei in it to tell the story of the internment of Japanese Americans and take it to Broadway. Note, we had never worked in the world of theater or on Broadway before in our entire lives. And it took a long time, but as crazy as that sounded, we first opened with George Takei and Tony Award winning Lea Salonga in San Diego in 2012, got incredible reviews and audience reaction, and then would open on Broadway in 2015 with George Takei. And what's really exciting is that Allegiance is the name of the show, is actually having a new production and will open in London with George Takei in the cast sometimes in the winter of 2022. So
wow.
very, very exciting.
That's super exciting.
Mix of experiences. Wow.
Yeah, very multifaceted background, but it's really interesting to hear about the inspiration that led to those achievements. So thanks for sharing that with us too.
Oh, you bet. Thank you.
At this point, we're going to move to our standard questions that we ask of all our guests at the end of each podcast. And this is an attempt to get to know you better. I feel like we've done a bunch of that already, but it's good to have some of your views. The first question is our National Venture Capital Association question. So the NVCA, as you may know, advocates for public policy that supports the venture community and the American entrepreneurial ecosystem. So if there's one thing that you would change about the VC industry or one policy that you would advocate for, what would it be?
So we are excited signatories onto an initiative that was born out of a small venture firm in LA called Act One Ventures, and that many other firms have then signed on, and we were amongst the first one. And it's called the Diversity Check Writers Term Sheet Initiative. And what it is a non-binding language that investors, VCs, and entrepreneurs and founders can adopt into their term sheets that effectively commits them, or at least in principle commits them, to making sure that not just in that round, but in every subsequent round for a company, that there is intentional room made for diverse capital sources. And it doesn't put specific constraints on how much money or what kind of ownership or what kind of diverse sources, but it's basically saying, hey, okay, we've spent all this time paying attention to who's making decisions and venture capital partnerships and C-suite and founders. And all of those are important ways in which we've achieved more diversity and inclusion and representation. But generational wealth is created by investing in top performing companies. And what happens is that very often in venture, there is some limited, but at least a little more democratization of access in the earliest stages, because there are so many companies chasing capital, and because ultimately the price to get in is smaller, and also because there is less information, right? Less is known about each individual company. But then the traditional venture strategy has you, hey, if you're lucky enough to have led around into a company that is then doing really, really well, what you want to do is you want to maximize your ownership and make sure that you are putting more capital at work, which of course, from a power law point of view of looking at returns in the fund, is a smart thing. But one externality of that is that even if there was some kind of less represented investor or underrepresented investor in the earlier stages, they're often cut out completely from later stage opportunities, both because maybe they can't invest as much money or simply because they become super competitive. And the term sheet initiative makes companies at least be intentionally reflecting on whether or not they're creating the right diversity mix in the capital sources for their cap table at each subsequent round of funding. I think that taking that and broadening it and adopting it in a broader sense from venture would go a really long way in making sure that not just the highest risk opportunities, but also some of the de-risked or somewhat de-risked high growth, high potential opportunities are open to investors that don't fit the traditional mold.
Got it. That's great. Second question, if you were not a VC investor and money was not a concern, what career would you have? And I know that your role is more than just VC investor, but
yeah,
what else would you do?
There's so many different things that sometimes I encounter or see, and I'm like, oh, if I had another life, I would do that. I mean, there's probably two I can mention. One, I would probably be a film director, a filmmaker. And to some extent, I've scratched that itch. I actually directed the film of Allegiance when it was brought to screens all over the world as a stage to screen adaptation. And then another Broadway show called Bandstand, I also directed the film of that. It's something that I've always had a passion. In fact, if you probably had found 13-year-old me and asked what I would be as an adult, I would have probably said a director, a filmmaker, as opposed to technologist or whatever, computer programmer. And then the other one, definitely not one that would make me a lot of money, but aspirationally is a pretty fantastic thing, is I would travel the world as a sailor on a sailboat.
That's awesome. Third question is, who is someone you look up to and why?
Oh, this is difficult. People are people always. And so they have good things to them and they have bad things to them. And there's always this tension between what does it say about a person when you say you look up to person A, person B, and person C. I think there are so many incredible figures in today's world that are doing some pretty amazing things for the world, but that have been controversial at various points in their lives. I, for years and still to this day, think Bill Gates is one of them. I have enormous respect for not just what he did and what he built, but the way in which he thought and does think about the impact that he can have on the world and the long-term consequences of the business and philanthropic decisions he makes. And in the same vein, Elon Musk is falling in that. I think that when they say with great power comes great responsibility, I think that wealth is power. And I think that understanding that there is one way in which people can have massive impact on the world through the expenditure of the wealth that they have accumulated, both philanthropically or building new companies that move civilization forward, I think it's a pretty awesome thing.
That's great. And fourth question is, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Ooh. I don't know if it was an advice or just something that I've picked up, but I remember very specifically when I started my first company, I was mentioning PowerSet, and I went from being a research scientist, technologist within a firm to then this high-paced world of Silicon Valley in 2003, starting a company. One of my mentors was my co-founder, Barney Pell, who was one of my two other co-founders on PowerSet. And one thing that I really noticed, and I don't recall it if it was a direct advice, but it's certainly something that I picked up from him, was the maniacal attention to his network, his contacts, the way in which he would build relationships, cater to them, foster them, feed them, know things about those relationships. Like the same way you're looking at data in other circumstances now, like looking at your personal network as a data. And this was, I think, back at a time when this was much like, I mean, LinkedIn had just possibly being born. And certainly there were no tools like they exist now to make this a lot easier. So it was a lot of notes and systems and tagging and things. And I really picked that up from him. And I think it has served me so well over the decades, but it's probably one of the most impactful things that I remember ever picking up from someone else was just the maniacal attention around understanding and knowing your network so that you can be not just the best at extracting value from it, that's fine, but the most impactful at delivering value to it, right? Because so much of it is making connections between people, between nodes and so on. And so if I think about the kind of things that we do all day long with Gangels and the way in which we help companies, it really comes from that point of view of knowing so much and engaging so much with your own network that you can be a connector, a node, a facilitator, and really have at your fingertips the information you need in order to deliver that value.
Right. Well, it's clear that that was very impactful, and you've certainly put that into practice with both your own network and Gangels, as you had mentioned. Well, we are very proud supporters and partners of Gangels and your mission. And so we really appreciate your time today, Lorenzo, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both for having me. It was such fun to talk about this.
And follow us on Twitter @ProofVC or on our website @proof.vc.